Thursday, the 9th of July. I'm in central London with Alex, who's one of the Free Gaza 21. Hi, Alex.
Hello.
You've recently returned from Israel. Can you tell us what happened?
I was deported against my will from Israel. Not that I had wanted to be in Israel. On the 30th of June, I set sail with 20 colleagues for Gaza. We attempted to reach Gaza and we were turned back by the Israeli forces. We were trying to break the blockade and enter Gaza by sea because Israel won't let us enter Gazan territory any other way. We were taking a small but symbolic number of items to the Gazans. I won't call it aid because we were taking paper, pens, toys and other such items that are prohibited from entering Gaza by the Israelis. We went on a small, decommissioned island hopper ferry, 21 peace activists and human rights activists. Before we set sail, we had the full support of the Cypriot authorities. The ship had been inspected, not only for what we were carrying, but also for our own safety. The Cypriot authorities sent down divers to check that the Israelis, for example, had not planted anything on our ship. They inspected the ship for our safety. They inspected it for customs. They checked all our passports, and we set sail with their blessing and their full support. We'd anticipated that the crossing would take us about 30 to 32 hours. We set sail 7:40 Monday morning, and at midnight, when we were still 14 hours out of Gazan waters, the Israeli army made a first contact with us. They warned us that they were aware that we were on a course for what they called a blockaded area, and that we should turn back immediately. At that point, our delegation leader, Huwaida Araf, radioed back to them that we were a group of 21 human rights activists carrying a small amount of aid to Gaza, that we had been inspected by the Cypriots who had cleared our course, and that we were going to continue and we were heading to Gaza and we were not approaching Israeli territory or Israeli waters. We were in international waters, we were headed to Gaza and we were not going to turn back. At about 1:30 in the morning, they contacted us again and said if we did not turn around immediately, they would open fire and the responsibility of our actions would be on the captain and crew. At that point, they jammed our radio, they blocked our GPS, they turned off our radar, and we were left alone in the dark. We had seen gunboats around us. They, at that point, only three. They'd gone on and off radar. When we last had the radar, they were near enough to be on radar, but we couldn't see them. We'd then seen their lights appear, then they turned their lights on and off, and we spent a very frightening 40 minutes crouching down on deck, spotting for Israeli gunboats. We had no further radio contact with them through the night, but from experience of what had happened on other boats, we at that point began to expect that they would try to wear us down all night before approaching us and trying to board us or force us back at dawn. We heard nothing more from them all night. Our radio remained jammed, our GPS was blocked, and at dawn, as the light came up, there were no gunboats on the horizon, and we thought at that moment they were just harassing us. They were just trying to intimidate us. We're going to be allowed through. And we had a lot of optimism at that point, because you must remember last year 5 boats did get through. Unfortunately, that was short-lived. At 6:30, they began contacting us again. And from that point, they just repeated a warning on the hour, every hour. You are approaching blockaded territory. Turn back immediately, or the responsibility for your actions will be on the captain and crew. It may even have been a recorded message, because they said the same thing every time. And every time, Huwaida responded, explained that we were 21 activists, that we were travelling to Gaza, we were not approaching Israel, we'd been inspected and approved by the Cypriots, and that we would continue. During the course of the morning, anything up to 8 gunboats appeared around us. And actually during daylight, our radio and GPS were restored. And we were able to see that through the night, when the captain had been steering only by the stars and compass, we'd only gone 7 miles off course. And we'd gone 7 miles to the west, towards Egyptian waters. We hadn't approached Israel. And we'd had the feeling they were trying to force us into Israeli waters so they could take it. We'd actually gone the other way. And we'd had confirmation of that from Larnaca port as well, because we'd had a GPS device on the upper deck, and Larnaca port had been able to follow us but not been able to make contact. So as well as our captain's log we have the GPS evidence of where we were at all times, and the Larnaca Port authorities will back us up on this. Some point in the morning, a Zodiac rib approached us, circled us, full of stormtroopers, and then backed off again. Again, we thought it was just harassment and intimidation. It wasn't until perhaps half past 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so after more than 12 hours of them harrying and harassing us, that we approached the 24-mile limit from Gaza. We were still well in international waters, and as we approached that limit, six of the ribs that they used for boarding appeared on the horizon. Again, we thought possibly they were just trying to intimidate us, because they came closer and then they stopped. And we stopped outside the 24-mile limit. They stopped. And we sat there for about 40 minutes. We heard nothing more from them, except the hourly warnings that we'd had and responded to. And then they went. They backed off. And we thought, okay, that's it. Game over. They've tried to intimidate us. They've realised that they can't stop us. They've left us alone. So we proceeded into Gazan waters. After 4 miles, 20 miles off the shore of Gazan waters, the six ribs appeared again. And within seconds, they'd roared up to our little fishing boat and were boarding us. They came with almost comedically disproportionate force. Apart from the 8 gunboats, which must have cost Israel a lot of money, and the aeroplane that was following us, the number of soldiers they had on these ribs, it was ridiculous. I mean, we were at the safety limit in having 21 passengers on their boat. I don't know how many more soldiers they tried to pour on to us. They came up dressed in full commando gear, looking absolutely ridiculous for sea. They had the big heavy boots, the vests with all the weapons and the ammunition and the guns. They all had all of their stockings over their heads. They'd cut their own eye holes out, and frankly didn't look frightening. They just looked ridiculous. They did board us with excessive force, though, because of the number of vessels that approached our little ferry. We were shaken violently from side to side. It's a little island, flat-bottomed island hopper ferry that goes at about 7 knots. So with all the waves of the boats around us, we were shaken violently. I'm amazed that nobody fell off at that point. What did happen was a lot of people fell over, including soldiers. Even the soldiers were falling over. And prior to them boarding us, when we realised that they were going to board, we'd made a decision out of safety to offer no kind of resistance, no kind of even passive resistance, just out of safety because of the state of our vessel. So we already had all the passengers sitting in the room in the ferry, minimal crew in the wheelhouse, and myself, one other member of crew, and two journalists from Al Jazeera on the upper deck. And we decided that we would comply with what the soldiers said out of safety. So as soon as they stormed the boat, the passengers were already in the room. Some of the soldiers rushed to the wheelhouse, and some of them rushed onto the upper deck. As they rushed up to the upper deck, they, of course, made a grab for everybody's cameras, pushed me to the ground first, but then saw all the men behind me and, of course, went to the men, pushed them very roughly to the deck, held them down with knees in their backs, tied their hands, and then tried to push them down the stairs. with the violent movement of the boat, I think we'd have been in danger of falling off the back of it if we hadn't gone down the stairs voluntarily. I was directed down the stairs with the motion of a gun in my back, but I walked. We were put into a room, at which point I saw that all of the young men had been tied with plastic clips around their wrists. All the passengers were already sitting peacefully in the room. Well, they've been sitting peacefully all along. From the moment we knew they were going to be boarded, they sat in the room and sang "We Will Not Go Down in Gaza Tonight," and just sat and sang while we were boarded. And when we got to the room, I could see that Adam Shapiro had been very roughly treated and was clearly in some discomfort and was being pulled and dragged by soldiers. Adam Kvist, I'd seen him being pushed and dragged by soldiers, even though he was offering no kind of resistance. And I could see that Hueda, the delegation leader, and Dennis, the captain, were not in the room. Now, during the course of the voyage, I only caught a glimpse of Dennis briefly. He was kept in the wheelhouse. Hueda had her hands tied tightly and was being dragged by the soldiers, and she was dragged into the galley while the rest of us were sat in the room. Now, she was tied up on the floor in the galley, and we weren't able to see her. We became very worried for her welfare because the soldiers couldn't handle the boat. They were trying to drive it too quickly, And it is a very difficult boat to handle. They were spinning it around all over the place. The journey had become very rough. Very quickly, people started suffering from seasickness, which they hadn't before. Even the soldiers were being sick. And because of the rough motion of the boat, everything was falling off the shelves in the galley, and we became aware that Haweda was sitting under falling glass. The jars of coffee and the glasses and everything else off the shelves was falling on Haweda. So Mairead Maguire, one of the passengers, the Irish Nobel Peace Prize winner, demanded access to Haweda, and the soldiers eventually allowed her, but they did drag her roughly. They tied her up and dragged her roughly to Haweda, and then just tied her up with Haweda. So we weren't able to know whether at that point whether the pair of them were okay. They were kept out of sight, and the soldiers wouldn't allow anybody else down to the galley to see what was happening there. We were no more than a couple of hours off the coast, and yet the soldiers boarded us at 3 and didn't take us into port until nearly 9. And in that time they kept us in silence, with most of the men tied up. They seized all our property. They piled up all our bags before I even got into the room. They took away all the cameras and phones that we had on us, and they searched the women for cameras and phones, and only the women. They said, "We're going to search the women first." They were all male soldiers, but they never did search the men. And they started by searching the Arabic women we had on board, ordered them to take off their life vests and lift up their loose outer clothes, and patted them down. They didn't search me nearly so thoroughly. I find that quite interesting. And the men weren't searched at all. We'd been able to see from the coastline that we were changing direction, apparently going round in circles. We thought possibly it was an attempt to either damage the boat or to disorient us, because one of the crew had been on the Lebanese ship in January that had been boarded, and she's a British citizen, and she was held incommunicado for 4 days after the ship was boarded, and the Israelis denied having her. And we were quite worried at that point that they were going to take us but deny having us, and that they were making sure that we couldn't get a message out to anybody about our location, and perhaps they were trying to make it look like something had happened to our ship. And before they took us into their port, they covered all the windows so that we couldn't see where we were going. Before they took us in, they ordered us all to hand over our passports, and we complied at that point because we were all upfront about who we are, open about our identities. None of us were concealing our identities. We didn't feel we had anything to conceal. They had face masks on, and I pointed that out to them. I don't need to hide who I am because I'm not ashamed of what I'm doing. So we handed over our passports, also with the hope of getting some consular assistance. And they then called us out by passports one by one, and we were ordered to walk up the gangplank with our hands behind our heads, like Guantanamo detainees. And we walked in to bright lights into an... So we couldn't see clearly. These lights were stunning us. And we walked into these bright lights into an army base. And it was certainly not just essential personnel there. There were literally hundreds of young soldiers who were jeering us as we came out, shouting abuse and taking photographs with their personal cameras and personal phones. And we were ordered out one by one into this abuse. We were then detained in an army hangar, separated, searched again. Haweda and Adam were separated from the group. We were not allowed access to any of our personal possessions. We were searched again and checked for phones. And then they began moving people without telling us where to. People would just sort of disappear. We were picked off in small groups and taken to... we were later taken to immigration detention, but I think we were first taken to a Shabak office. We were taken for security examination and more checks. And as I was being driven away, we saw that our boat had been picked up, not in a cradle, but what looked like a giant grabber of the sort, same sort of shape as the thing that you used to grab toys in the fairground game. It was very unsecure, and the boat was being shaken violently backwards and forwards. And we said, "Why are you doing that?" And they said, "We're shaking it to see if there are explosives on board." Now, obviously ridiculous, because they'd shaken it quite violently at sea when they were on board. If they felt that it was at risk of exploding, I don't think they'd have done that. And they were doing this above their own troops who were standing on the dock. So I think that was simply to damage the boat. We were then taken to the Shebeck offices, fingerprinted, photographed. Nobody would explain to us what was going on. Nobody would tell us why we'd been taken or where we were going. Some of us were separated. I was separated from the others for a few hours because I have a Palestinian connection. I'm married to a Palestinian, and this year I got Palestinian citizenship. At this point, they began saying to people, will you make a voluntary departure before you're deported? There will be a deportation order against you, but you can go voluntarily tonight. And we all said, yes, we want to go. We were abducted here. We don't want to be here. Take us back where you found us, or deport us to Palestine, or even to Cyprus. We'll go. Let us go. But they wouldn't allow that. We realised quite quickly then that they were going to put us in immigration detention and make a deportation order against us. And at that point, we decided, the Westerns in the group decided that we were not going to leave. Not because we didn't want to leave, we didn't want to be there in the first place, but we had Arabs in the group. We had 5 Bahrainis and 2 Al Jazeera journalists, one from Qatar, one from Jordan, and we felt that they were much more vulnerable than us. We, knowing that their countries didn't have diplomatic relations with Israel, we were worried that they would languish in prison for months or perhaps just be disappeared. So as Westerners, we decided that we would refuse to leave until the Arabs had been safely returned to Cyprus, where we'd come from, where they had multi-entry visas, and where, under international law, they could be returned to, because that's where they'd come from. We also said we wouldn't leave until our equipment was returned to us. By that I mean the electronic equipment. We weren't expecting, at that point, the boat or cargo to be returned to us, and of course it won't be. So we were transferred to immigration detention. I wasn't transferred until 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd been, for 12 hours then, been asking for water, and the army had said, oh, when you get to immigration. And immigration, it wasn't on their schedule until the next day. It took me until 3 o'clock the next afternoon, when my consul turned up, to be able to get clean water to drink.
This was Ramla prison, was it? Or Ben Gurion?
Yeah, this was Ben Gurion. We set sail on the Monday. We were taken on the Tuesday. In the early hours of Wednesday morning, we were transferred to immigration. Wednesday afternoon, we were then transferred to Ramleh. Again, the men and women were separated through all of this, so we weren't able to talk to the men in the group. When we left immigration in pairs, they assured us that we were all going to Ramleh. And of course, when we got to Ramleh, we found that Mairead Maguire, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, wasn't with us, and all the Arabs weren't with us. At that point, we became very afraid for their safety, for the safety of the Arabs. We realised that with Mairead, they would have just tried to deport her immediately. She actually turned up a couple of hours later. They had tried to deport her, and she'd refused without her equipment and without knowing that our Arabic friends were safe. So on Wednesday, we were put into Ramleh prison. At Ramleh prison, immigration had told us that when we got to the prison, our belongings would be returned to us. When we got to Ramleh prison, some of our bags were there. Some of our clothes were there. Anything capable of conducting electrical current had been removed. Cameras, laptops, phones, iPods, any kind of cable. Also personal items, anything with Arabic writing on it, T-shirts, banknotes, my Jordanian banknotes were taken, copies of my wedding certificate, my bank cards, my ID, and other small items of toiletries, things that they seem to have removed at random. The prison guards let us choose some items to take in with us. The women were all detained on the same wing, but we were in separate cells. So I had the privilege of being in a cell with some incredible young women from Ethiopia, Darfur, and the Philippines. And prison is an unpleasant experience. As prisons go, I don't think it was the worst. The women we met in prison told us that conditions improved significantly because we were there. They were given more protein to eat. They were given bread. They were given eggs or meat every day while we were there. The men later told us that they were given milk every day. And the women didn't get milk, but that was an improvement on general prison conditions. We were allowed out of our cells between 3 and 6 hours a day. According to the schedule on the wall, it should have been 6 hours a day. By the mood of the guards, it was down to 3 hours a day, and in that time I was able to meet the other female members of our group and do interviews with the women in the prison. And as desperately sad and frustrated and disappointed as we were not to reach Gaza, the Israelis unwittingly gave us another opportunity, to meet another group of forgotten people, another group that they tried to keep hidden. So it wasn't a wasted experience. At one point, the immigration officials threatened to punish us by sending us to Masyal prison, which is a higher security prison. And we said, great, send us. Human rights workers have been trying to get in there for years. We've been trying to get monitors in, send us. So obviously they then declined. We've been trying to get out some of the accounts of the women that we met. In my cell, I had migrant workers who were picked up while their visas were still running, sometimes with a month or more left. And I had people with UN papers, all of whom were being detained illegally and indefinitely. They were held with no charge against them. They didn't know why they were being held, and they didn't know whether they would be released or sent home. None of the women in my cell had been there less than 6 months. They had been there for up to 2 years. I had two women who had been in employment in Israel, had problems with their employer, hadn't been paid, had complained to the authorities, and then had just been detained for that. Others had UN papers but were picked up before their papers even expired, and then been told by the UN that the UN simply couldn't help in Israel because they were not in control of what the Israelis did. I had a woman from Darfur who's been there for, she's 19 years old, and she'd been there for a year and 9 months and had no way to go home. I had two women, one from India, one from the Philippines, who had children in Israel. They were in their 50s. They'd been there for more than 10 years. One of them had a very young child and had been in prison. One had been in prison for 19 months. One had been in prison for 6 months. And they hadn't seen their children in all that time. Their children had been taken into care. They were awaiting deportation, but the Israelis hadn't organized anything, and they were just languishing in prison. They don't have visitors. They don't have anybody in their home countries that can look after them. Their family and friends are hundreds and thousands of miles away, and for the most part they had abusive employers in Israel who have been responsible for landing them in there. So it was very hard to feel upset about being in prison. I obviously, when I think about not getting to Gaza, we did feel very upset and very disappointed for our Gazan friends, who lost yet another opportunity to make contact with the outside world and to have their stories heard and to have their experiences witnessed. But there was so much else to think about and so many other stories to listen to in prison that we didn't really take that in. On the second day, on the day after we were transferred to the prison, on the Thursday morning, I was presented with a document in Hebrew, which obviously I couldn't read, but I could make out my name, my passport number, my date of birth, and my prison number. Some of the young women in my cell were able to look at it for me and told me it was a deportation order, which wouldn't be enacted within 72 hours, but it had been signed on the Wednesday, so any time from Saturday afternoon I was liable to be deported. Although we weren't allowed our phones, other prisoners in Ramleh were allowed to have phones, so we were able to get messages out to our land crew in Cyprus and to our lawyer in Palestine about what was happening to us. And we were advised that our lawyer was appealing the deportation, but that wouldn't actually mean that it would be stopped. He would also need to apply for a stay on deportation so that the hearing would happen while we were in country, and that would be the only way to expedite the hearing. Otherwise, it may take 2 years to come to court. So the lawyer was seeking that. The grounds for my deportation were that I was illegally present in Israel. This is obviously ridiculous and perverse. I was not approaching Israel. I had not wanted to be in Israel. I was abducted at gunpoint into Israel by Israeli armed forces. On Friday, a woman from the Ministry of the Interior came to the prison, identified herself as a judge. I later found out that she wasn't, and asked to speak to us, but wouldn't explain that she was going to conduct a hearing, but wouldn't tell us what it was about, would not allow us to call our lawyer or bring our lawyer for the hearing. So I explained that I wasn't happy to say anything without understanding the purpose or without my lawyer present. My lawyer later told me that that was not an appeal of my deportation, it was simply a detention review about whether or not I could be bailed pending the deportation, and she had decided that I couldn't be. But not knowing that that was the purpose of the hearing, I'd never presented any reasons why I should be bailed. But she again also insisted that I was being deported because I was illegally present in Israel. And I said to her, it's illegal for me to be here. Yes, I came here illegally. Yes, she said. I said, oh, good. Can you then go and arrest the men who brought me here at gunpoint then? And she said, you were brought here at gunpoint? Yes. Your friends have guns, she said. No, they were not my friends. But she was so incapable of understanding the issues that when I said I was brought there at gunpoint, she assumed that the crew of the ship had guns. She explained to me that in her view, I was in Israeli territory, and the other Ministry of Interior officials that I spoke to, as well as the lower officials in the prisons and the army and the guards, everybody I spoke to insisted to me that I had been in Israeli territory when I was taken. Now, the Cypriots and our GPS devices and our captain's log all confirm that we travelled through international waters and we were approaching Gazan waters when we were taken. We were not on a course for Israeli waters. And to my knowledge, the Israelis are not disputing our physical position. They are simply asserting that that is Israeli territory. And they said we were breaking an Israeli blockade and going into Israeli territory. And every time I insisted we were in Gazan territory, they said, it's all the same. It's all Israel. And that was not just the lower officials. That was the whole basis for my deportation. The only legal document I have was that I was held in prison pending deportation for being in Israel illegally. So they have consistently asserted Israeli sovereignty over that water, and I think that's important to note. They have said that that was Israel. And that's in complete contradiction of all their denials that they are the occupying power. They, at this point, claim that they're no longer occupying Gaza. And yet when we approach that piece of water, oh, that's Gaza, that's Israeli territory. And that's not just a soldier saying that. That's a court document that says that. So I'm quite appreciative that they've given me this document and this deportation order with their assertion that that piece of territory is Israeli, because that exposes their lies.
Okay, so unilateral disengagement was a lie all along. What a surprise. What do you know about conditions in Gaza at the moment?
We don't know enough about conditions in Gaza. That's the whole reason we were going. I initially got involved with ISM through meeting ISMers through the Stop the War campaign back in 2002, 2003. And I made up my mind to go after they killed Rachel Corrie and fatally injured Tom Herndl. Because my thought at the time was, my goodness, if what they are doing is so bad that they will kill us to stop us seeing it, it is vital that we go. And at that point I got into the West Bank and tried and failed to get into Gaza. And then over the next 6 years, I've seen and experienced how hard they've made it for us to get into West Bank and how they particularly go after people who are there to witness. The fact that they make it so much harder for us to go into Gaza only proves to me that what they don't want us to witness there is even worse, so it's absolutely vital for us to get in. There are a small number of activists who went there last year on the boats, and the stories that they are sending out are absolutely horrifying. It's vital that we get in and see what's happening, and the reason that we're going in by boat is Israel will not allow us in any other way.
And in fact, right now there's two British activists trapped at Rafah Crossing who the Egyptians won't let out. And I think, you know, that's worth noting, is that the Egyptians have hindered people getting in as well.
Well, you say the Egyptians, but we know who's controlling them. We know who's behind that.
Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, these are Egyptian armed forces who are preventing and physically harassing these women at Rafah. I understand that the Egyptian ministry has given permission for them to leave, but it's the Secret Service who won't let them out.
Absolutely. And the same has happened time and time again with the Egyptians and that border in both directions. Aid workers, humanitarian workers, journalists and doctors have all been given permission from the authorities in Cairo and yet been stopped on the road approaching the border. This isn't new. This is what the Egyptians have done all along.
Okay. Did you have any consular assistance while you were detained in Israel?
I did. We informed the British Embassy in Tel Aviv of our intention to travel before we went, and we also signed consent forms allowing the consul to speak to our land crew in Cyprus and our families on our behalf. And due to our contact we had on our satellite phones and the alarms being sent out by our spotter beacon, our land crew in Cyprus knew immediately when we were boarded and immediately called our lawyer and our consuls and asked our consuls to start calling the Israeli authorities asking about our whereabouts. We were particularly concerned to do this because after the Lebanese boat was taken in January, the Israelis denied having British citizens. So this time we were prepared for that, and the British consul and the Irish consul were able to get access to us in immigration detention on Wednesday afternoon. So about 24 hours after the army took us, the consul was able to get access to us. The officials played their usual games. They lied to the consul and said we weren't there. They lied to us and said he wasn't there. And at that point, we could make eye contact through the window. They played the same games with the lawyer. And they lied to our consul and our lawyer about where they were sending us to when they transferred us to Ramleh prison. The usual.
Okay. Since you've been back, there's been a decided lack of reporting of this in the British press. Have you got any idea of why that might be?
It's very clear to me that the British press are afraid of the Zionist lobby. I'm sure people are thinking, well, you would say that, but I'll give you an example. Not so long ago, a Greenpeace ship approached a Japanese whaling ship, and some of their activists were abducted by the Japanese. They were a smaller number of activists, they weren't British citizens, and yet that story got minute by minute coverage from the BBC. In our case, 21 of us, including a US congresswoman and a Nobel Peace Prize winner, were abducted by the Israelis and held for a week. There were six British citizens on board. We had phones, we were getting messages out, we had images, we do have camera footage. We cannot persuade the BBC to take the story. We cannot persuade the mainstream press to take the story. The only people that have covered it are Indy Media, Al Jazeera and Press TV. My local papers have been fascinated. The journalists on my local papers have said to me, why is nobody else covering this? This is a big story. This is a really interesting story. I'm grateful to be able to cover this. And yet we can't get the mainstream media to take it. Contrast the two stories. Press TV gave me another example of the US State Department's response when the Iranian-American journalist was released. Hillary Clinton made a statement welcoming her release, a gushing statement saying how much she'd been worried. And yet when Cynthia McKinney came home, nothing was said. Just imagine if a group of Westerners were taken by Arabs. Imagine the wall-to-wall coverage that would get. Compare the stories you've seen in the media this week about British soldiers in Afghanistan or about the mercenaries that were killed in Iraq. They've had far more coverage and there's a far smaller number of them. It's clear bias.
Right. If people want to get involved with Free Gaza, and there's quite a lot of need, both in terms of raising funds and in terms of people willing to go there, how would they go about it?
First thing to do is go to the website, freegaza.org. If you want minute-by-minute updates of what's happening, go to our live page. Please donate. Please get in touch with our land crew in Cyprus. If you have any other skills to offer, if you have particular skills that would be useful on the boats, or if you have media or lobbying skills, any kind of admin skills that you can lend. We are a very small number of individuals. We are not an NGO. We don't have a charity or an organisation behind us. We are a collective of individuals who are just working very, very hard. And our land crew have done an amazing job with what was an unexpectedly high workload this week. Just the number of phone calls alone has swamped them. If you can offer any support with that, if you've got some skills you'd like to share, that would be great. Please go to freegaza.org.
Okay, thanks very much.